Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Tom Gallant. He's just published a novel called The Lord God Bird. Welcome to the program, Tom.
It's great to be here, Vic. I appreciate it.
Tom, I heard a rumor that you started writing this book on your schooner. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I heard about the case of the man reportedly seeing the Lord God Bird in, I think it was 2004, on a radio program on CBC in Canada, and I made some notes. I just thought that it was an interesting phrase and everything. And then I circled around the idea for years, kept trying to start it, and I never had the tone of voice right. It always bothered me, so I'd write 10 pages and throw it away, and write 10 pages and throw it away. And then I was on my schooner in Lunenburg Harbor to ride out this hurricane named Earl, I think it was. So, you know, it doubled up all the lines and all that sort of stuff, and I was down below, you know, sitting in the main saloon there, and I had my notebook with me, and I opened it up, and I wrote the first chapter. It just came out, and then after I'd written it, I brought it home and looked at it and said, "There it is. That's the voice," because that's the whole thing with telling a story. I think is that the voice be the right one, you know.
And it's your voice, but it's also the voices of a man and a bird. And you alluded to the bird in your title, "The Lord God Bird." This is a bird of legend now, isn't it?
It's probably the most mourned and searched for of the birds that have gone extinct, the ivory-billed woodpecker. It's the biggest woodpecker. There's one in Mexico that's a cousin of it that's about that big. Really beautiful, beautiful creature, and very kind of dramatic and... And so when they thought they found the bird, there was a huge burst of enthusiasm, and it made the front pages of papers and all that sort of thing. And my interest grew around the story when the Cornell Lab of Ornithology had sent a team down there to do a search, and they'd mounted cameras in trees and done a systematic search of what was left of the big woods in Arkansas. And they came back with 4 seconds of film, which they initially claimed proved the existence of the ivory-billed woodpecker, and then all the other expert ornithologists in the world disputed that. And there was a bit of a controversy. Is the bird there? Isn't the bird there? There were T-shirts, "I believe," and all that sort of thing. And when all that was going on, I kept wondering, well, you know, what if the man actually did see the bird? And what if the man and the bird could understand one another? What would that conversation have been? And how would they communicate, you know? And that's what got me going.
And what kind of a man would the bird want to communicate with?
That's absolutely. Why did the bird choose to reveal himself to this man? And so, you know, it's funny. You think, I mean, I'm not one of these guys who makes an outline and a plot outline and all that sort of stuff. I usually know approximately how the book's going to end, and I know who the protagonists are, and that's about it when I start. And then I have a ritual that involves writing before I write. You know, I have a journal, and I'll read what I wrote the day before and then write about, okay, if that happened then what should happen now is, and I'll write that down and then address the empty page and just carry on.
Tom Gallant joins us. His novel is The Lord God Bird. It's written in a character that's quite a bit like the man. It's very much bare bones, very much essentials. It's a lifestyle that this man has that is very much in tune with his surroundings. Let's talk about him.
Well, that was it's an interesting thing because a lot of things circled around him when the book was unfolding, and you know, one thing was, what's his name? And I kept resisting the impulse to name the guy for no good reason at first, but as the book carried on, and I became more and more, I don't know what's the right word here, but more and more aware of who he was and what he was like and how he addressed things. It became more and more, sensible to me that he wouldn't have to have a name, that he would just be this man. And his qualities would express themselves through action and through the things that he says. And, you know, you remarked upon the language, and it struck me that everything had to be of a piece so that, you know, I mean, I've got nothing against metaphors. I don't think there's any in the book. There might be one simile in there, but a lot of the time, metaphors tend to be writers saying, "Look at me, look at how smart I am, look at how elegantly I can write." And sometimes, and a lot of time, they're not. Too, a lot of time, they're something that brings you into a deeper understanding of what's going on. But in the case of this book, where the intention became, as the book unfolded for me, a meditation on how we should be with the earth and with our day, and with those around us, with ourselves, and with the animals and the plants and all the rest of that. To get high flown with the language would have been really counterproductive, I think.
A moment ago, you alluded to the fact that the woodpecker chose to communicate with the man, and this, of course, implies that we're going to be reading about what the woodpecker is thinking and doing, and the woodpecker and the man are very similar in that they don't have names, and they live how they live.
Yes, both of them are, it's funny, but there's, you know, if you started to look around for a philosophy or a guiding set of principles that characterizes the woodpecker and the man, it would be that kind of Buddhist notion of that Zen notion of being in the present and accepting everything as it comes with kind of equanimity and not getting your nose out of joint because it's raining when you wish the sun was shining. And there was something there. When I started the book, I had no idea that my sense of planetary loss was so profound. I had no idea that my opinions, although I had held them for a long, long time, about the wrongheadedness of the way humans, in an analytical way, try to understand animals, and the wrongheadedness in the way that we treat the planet. I didn't know that any of those things were that strong and that well developed, and so as the story unfolded, you know, the first problem for me as a writer was, how do I have the birds communicate with one another and ultimately, finally, towards the end, with the man, without making it a Walt Disney cartoon, you know? And so it's always been my intuition and actually fairly ferocious conviction that animals share a kind of telepathic understanding of what's going on between one another in the world. And, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand how that could be if you just looked honestly at how we humans behave with one another. I mean, for sure, you've walked into a room and, gazed upon the face of another human being and known immediately that there was something wrong or that there was something right. And probably had a fairly strong intuition of what might have caused that state of affairs. And why we, you know, so arrogantly suggest that animals don't know that. I mean, it's kind of funny now. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that as scientists get cleverer and cleverer at coming up with tests for animals, they're now, I mean, for a while they said, well, animals don't feel empathy. And then they figured out that the bonobos did. And then they figured out that, you know, this one did and that one did. And now it's starting to come clear to them that they all do, you know.
We've become so disconnected. The man feels loss. He feels the loss of his beloved wife. He feels the loss of the great woods around him and the creatures that live there. And the bird and the birds feel the same, and you have some wonderful interludes in the book where the bird communicates with an ancient bear, and they talk about the panthers, and the ivory bill communicates with the crows, who he doesn't really like that much, but they're useful.
Yeah, yeah. He finds them smart, Alex. And which they are.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you watch crows, I mean, they're fearless and they're very busy and they're goofy and they're playful and they're noisy and you know, they really are they're smart alecks for birds.
And then there's everybody's favorite character, Paul.
Yeah, don't you wish you had Paul?
I do.
Yeah, me too. It's one of the first things my publisher said after he read the book. He said, look, when the movies buy this, I want the canoe they have to make, and I want Paul.
Yeah. Paul is a wonderful hound.
He is a good hound dog.
And he's growing up. We're watching him grow and mature and develop throughout the story.
Paul was more fun to write than anything else in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I've known some good dogs in my time, and I had a hound when I was a kid, and they're very kind of smart and empathetic and everything, but they're also totally individuals. And I love that passage in the book where the little girl is saying to the man, you know, Paul doesn't listen. He just goes off by himself and gets his nose in the ground, and he'll get himself in a pickle, you know. and the man explains, well, no, you know, the thing is, that's what hound dogs do. But if you just ignore him and start doing something interesting, he'll come back and check on you. You see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that happens to be the way you handle a hound. You know, it really does work if you've got a good one. And I would advise that anyone looking at getting a hound dog, do what the man did. Get a boy from the middle of the pack. Don't get the alpha dog.
Uh-huh.
Because the alpha dog just won't listen.
And he gets the dog from his neighbor who's had a litter. And this is really wonderful to read about the relationship the man has with his neighbors. That they were boyhood pals, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they grew up together. Which I suppose might have been remarkable back in those times, because we're talking Arkansas and the neighbor is black and he's white. And the thing I love is that they're both completely colorblind. Mm-hmm. They don't see that at all. They just see one another. And, you know, there are... So rather than make an argument, if I could get on a soapbox on Hyde Park Corner and rant and roar about the evils of war and the evils of racism and the evils of denying global warming and the evils of unkindness and all of that sort of stuff and pollution, and nobody would hear me because people are tired of being shouted at.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you can write a book like this, which is a quiet story, and maybe people will have a little change of heart when they read it, or the good part of their heart will get filled or something. I don't know.
I would recommend it to anyone who's sitting there right now with their smartphone, sending an email or doing whatever it is people do on those things. How do you feel when you walk down the street and you see people staring at their little devices, or you go into a restaurant and you see people having dinner together, but they're not paying any attention to one another? They've got their little smartphones out and or their little tablet computers, and they're completely immersed in whatever it is that's inside those little boxes.
They're totally not present. It makes me sad when I see that. I feel like there's something, you know, there's the scientists in the book have their computers, and they are inordinately fascinated with what's on the screens of their computers, and so they're not truly present with the man when they're in the woods looking for the bird and so on. And that's how I'm dealing with that part of life. But, you know, we have allowed a technology that's not even 30 years old, not even 20 years old, in its kind of adolescence as a technology right now, to completely mitigate our lives and to take us away from a way of being that we were comfortable with for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And something about that doesn't sit all that well with me. It makes me afraid for people. And when I see the kind of, what do they call it on the web pages, flaming or something?
Something going viral.
Yeah, goes viral, and people write things, and they're anonymous, and they write things that are so, well, actually the best word for it is to just damn impolite.
Uh-huh.
You know, but so unkind and so violent, and there was a time when that kind of talk was completely inappropriate, and if you did it, all around you would, you know, either walk away or shut down or say something.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't talk like that. People don't treat one another like that. And I don't think, if you look at the quality of interaction, I mean, you know, it's strange because what goes on in the book? I mean, a guy goes for a canoe ride. A guy builds a canoe. He also has an old canoe, and he goes into the woods, and he sees this bird, and the scientists come down to see if the sighting is true, and some people arrive and stay at his house, and then they leave, and he carries on with life. And in the course of the story, he finds a new love and so on. But it's a very, very quiet little story, and there's a lot of breathing room in it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the language is so spare, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is... you know, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say, well, I knew how to do that when I started, and that's on purpose. That's just what happened. That's how it came. And when you look at the kind of thing that's being put out there in front of people to, you know, what's the purpose of telling a story? It's to get at a truth that we can't get at any other way. when you see the stuff that's being put out there, I often wonder, I mean, what possible good can come of this? Lots of movies that you see nowadays have no air in them. There's no room to breathe. There's no way for a conversation to drift a little bit, go here and go there. And that's those are the moments where people are most themselves, and where, you know, when the plot gets out of the way and just lets the characters be. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, I'll tell you what, I think that's why books are not going to die. People can say what they want, but books are going to continue. And physical books, too.
Thank you for that.
Didn't they do a beautiful job making this book?
I think they did.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
I'm so impressed.
And this is a wonderful little press. The book is The Lord God Bird. Tom Gallant wrote it. It was published by the Quantuck Lane Press. And it was just published. He joins us on the program today. I looked at some of your information. I know you did a little research on me. Well, I did a little bit on you, and I saw where apparently something happened to you about 20 years ago that was very significant and tragic, and you wrote a book about that. Do you want to talk about that at all?
This was in 1992. And my wife and I were on our way to somewhere, and we were at a four-way intersection. And as we entered the intersection, my wife was driving, and we were blindsided on the driver's side door by an inner-city bus. And my wife was in a coma for 6 weeks, and I was told to pull a plug. And I said, well, no, I don't think I'll pull the plug. And I was in the hospital with her every day for 6 months, 3 months in the hospital, 3 months in a rehabilitation center, and then brought her home, and we continue to be here to this day. And eventually, I wrote a book about it called A Hard Chance, Sailing into the Heart of Love. I think you could find it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And, it won some awards up here and stuff. It was kind of my re-entry into the literary world, which is a better way for me to live now, because I can't really go out. I was a musician, songwriter, performer, actor, all that sort of stuff, and I can't really do that and be away from home for, 6 months at a time or 4 months at a time. Although Alyssa's perfectly capable of taking care of herself for a certain amount of time,
And
so it was, but it was a lesson in, it's probably part of what gave me the whatever insight it took to write The Lord God Bird, in the sense that the only way to properly live through a challenge like that one was to accept everything as it came, without any questions, without any arguments. Okay, this is the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
This is the best thing to do. I'll do that. And everything absolutely must, in a circumstance like that, proceed from love. It can't proceed from anything else, or else it'll end up souring your universe,
And loving one another, that's really the bottom line. Loving our planet, loving each other. We need a little bit more of that, don't we?
Oh, yeah. The thing is, it's such a the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. I mean, they were right, you see. But, we forget that, we just kind of say, oh, well, yeah, everybody knows that, and carry on, but we don't actually sit down and address the truth of it in a profound and serious way. And probably that's a lot of what this book is about.
And the man in the book is a kindred spirit of yours, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love the guy. I just love him. And, he's drawn from a few examples. There are pieces of three or four men that I've known through my life in him. One is the man that built my boat. Another is one of the carpenters that the lead hand that worked on it. That's where I got all that stuff about how you address a tool and how you. Another was my old uncle Stafford, who's the first guy that told me, you know, that joke about the axe that's in the book.
Uh huh.
You know that yeah. that was Uncle Stafford that told me that.
Uh huh.
My old Uncle Stafford.
Yeah. So. How old is that axe?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that. You know, I've had that axe for 40 years. Best tool I ever bought. Yeah, mind you, it's had, you know, 4 new handles and 3 new heads, but it's the same axe.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
The book is The Lord God Bird. Tom Gallant wrote it, and it was recently published by the Quantuck Lane Press, and it's definitely worth tracking down. In fact, I can't remember the last time I read a book that touched me as deeply as this one did.
That's awfully kind of you to say.
Well, I mean it. It really is powerful, and it was exactly what I needed.
Well, that's just wonderful. I don't know Alexander McCall Smith, you know, the guy that wrote the number one ladies' detective agency series in the Scotland Street novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I just finished reading one of the Scotland Street novels, and there is an unabashed acknowledgement in all of that man's work that if, you know, that love is the only sensible response to life.
Mm.
And it's there all the time, and it's not sentimental. It's serious. And I thought, well, you know, if anybody'd get this book, he would. So I found a way to get it to him, and he did.
That's wonderful.
You know, and it was a day that gave me the courage because, you know, publishing with, you know, an exquisite little boutique press like Quantuck Lane, as a relative unknown, this is my first book to be, you know, distributed in the States. As a relatively unknown author, or completely unknown, it's chaotic undertaking at best, you know. And of course, your fears are that, well, you know, once I put my work out on a stage that big, somebody's going to shoot the legs out from under me, and maybe I'm crazy, and maybe this isn't really as good as I hope and pray it is.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, I appreciate your calling, and you know, and I appreciate your affection for the book.
The book is The Lord God Bird. Tom Gallant wrote it, and you heard about it on The Book Nook. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in. One of the biggest books that came out last year was called Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. It was written by Mitchell Zuckoff. This is quite a story, and there's a Dayton connection. Tune in for this one next week in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.